This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ron Insana, Senior Advisor to Schroders North America, and welcome to the U.S. Lens. As you well know, we're kicking off third quarter earnings season this week with the big banks in the United States reporting their results in an environment that has been somewhat unfriendly to the nation's big and small banks from an interest rate perspective, from a business perspective, given the lockdown, the ongoing coronavirus crisis here in the United States and other factors. Are there reasons to be optimistic about earnings season for the big banks and for all different types of credit? Joining me now to talk about that is David Knutson. He is head of credit research at North America at Schroders. David, thanks for being with us. And here we are in third quarter earnings season, and we're starting to hear people, not just with respect to banks, but even more broadly, talk about a season that may support stocks overall. Are you optimistic that third quarter earnings will start to look better than some had anticipated or feared, for that matter?
I do. Good morning, and thanks for this opportunity. I think that we are going to be surprised at the resilience of the American economy in general. The other surprise that we will, when we look back at this period, we'll be surprised at how quickly and how forcefully the federal government acted in response to the pandemic back in March and April. In regards to the big banks, you know, there's a slow evolution away from risk. So if you look at the big banks, which this week, you know, you'll get about 60 to 70% of all of the banking assets having reported. So this is really the week that's going to set the tone for the rest of the earnings season. But if you look at the banks, cash and treasuries and other low risk government guaranteed securities are comprising over a third of the balance sheets of these big banks. Banks have de-risked. They de-risked early and quickly in lending standards. The asset quality problems haven't really materialized because of the largesse or the federal fiscal and monetary stimulus. So that's elongated the credit cycle. And what that just basically means is that banks will have the time and the ability to manage through some of the issues that we will see eventually come up when the great sorting occurs. As far as other industries,
Let me just ask you about that. So it appears that the banks have squirreled away enough capital, enough cash, but as you said, they haven't yet encountered as much in the way of non-performing loans, foreclosures on real estate. Is that because there's been effectively forbearance of those issues, or have their customers been able to make their nut every month?
You know, it's a combination of both. You've had regulatory support for forbearance, which is critical when it comes to banking. A regulator can be very critical of a loan that's still paying, or can be generous with a loan that's not paying, and that's essentially forbearance. And that's been embraced by over a dozen or over a half dozen regulators. The accounting industry has also had accounting flex built into their measurement of asset quality, and then you actually, you know, the 800-pound gorilla in the room is just more than two and a half trillion dollars was drilled into the economy, and I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it was essentially a backdoor support or capital build for the banks.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because not everybody views it that way, and it's certainly not been sold that way in the same way that it was during the great financial crisis, that it was an obvious, let's say, bailout, or as you say, backdoor support. That was a front door pouring in of capital. So you're basically suggesting that the government's given the banks a big cushion to weather the storm.
Exactly, because I think policymakers quickly realized this pandemic wasn't generated by bad or wildcat lending in residential real estate or the oil patch or some trading scandal. You know, it wasn't centered on the financial system. It was an act of God. It was something that no one predicted, and it wasn't really a particular industry or sector of the economy's fault. And so the way you deal with this is you keep it contained, and you do not allow it to spread to the financial industry, because once it spreads into the financial industry, the recovery rate is much slower and much longer and much more painful and much more difficult to manage, because, you know, banks are still levered. They're the most levered part of the corporate segment, and any loss of trust or confidence, I don't care if you're JP Morgan or some small bank in Iowa, you're still going to really struggle.
So let me ask you one more question about the bank specifically before we widen the conversation to include the credit markets. There's been so much talk about whether or not banks can make money on the so-called spread, net interest margin. The yield curve has been relatively flat, but it's steepened a little bit lately. Is that a pertinent issue in an environment like this? I know in the great financial crisis, no one would buy the banks. And I'm not asking for a recommendation on the stocks themselves, but no one would buy the banks because net interest margins were too flat, when in fact we were really just basing the buy, if you will, on a recovery in the economy. Are there any analogs here when you look at the banks?
Yeah, I think there is. So nowadays, loans actually make up less than half of the big banks' books for the first time on record, less than half. So, you know, the answer to the question is the larger banks, so let's say the top 25 banks in the United States, are not as levered to or is not exposed to the curve as they were maybe a decade or two ago, or certainly other banking systems. I would point to the European banking system is much more exposed. And so why? The U.S. banks make a lot of money from fees. And Jamie Dimon said it at a conference years ago that if you can't charge for the hamburger, you charge more for the Coke. And so the U.S. banks have a very flexible operating model. And like I said, the assets of traditional lending assets really are not as heavy in the larger banks as they are. And for that reason, when you look and you regress net interest margin relative to the shape of the treasury curve, you don't find a very robust correlation.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
All right, now we're 3 weeks from the election. With respect to banks that may face different types of regulations if we get a different administration, and credit markets more broadly could see some changes in policy as well when it comes to taxation and the like. What do you expect to see? How do you expect these markets to absorb information in the next several weeks?
So I like to even make it more dramatic. We're 500 hours from D-Day. 3 weeks doesn't quite grasp the event, but it's going to be, it is the big event that the markets are focused on. And the whether you look in the options market or other markets, you notice there's a kink, sort of in finance terms, when you get around the election. And it isn't so much the election day itself, it's the days and weeks after the election. It's the nature of this election being a mail-in election, and the issues and the timing required to find a true winner, and whether or not people will be patient or declare early victories. However, you know, I think about this in the month of October. If someone shows up to my door in about a week or two at night and dressed in a scary costume and rings my doorbell, I'm probably not going to be scared. But if they do that 2 weeks later, I'm probably going to be pretty frightened. So the point of that is, I think the market has been preparing for an election volatility and has been taking measures. Certainly the large banks have been building cash, have been looking at contingency plans. I think other parts of the economy have also recognized this risk. And so essentially, when you have a known known, it's you just don't get paid for it, and it probably doesn't materialize in the same way.
Yeah, it's interesting. You have the VIX kink that you mentioned, or volatility kink. Some people are now suggesting that we could see 70% of Americans having voted even before the election and get a result on November 3rd. So they're shorting the kink, if you will, as opposed to playing the volatility.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, there is over, 5 or 6 million as of a week or two ago, people that have already voted. And, you know, when you I think they said it in the context of some of the debates, you know, I think people, this is a very polarized election, and that's not news to anyone. And I think people made up their minds probably years ago who they were going to vote for. They didn't know who exactly was going to be on the ticket, at least half of it.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about another issue, and I'm going to pivot towards ESG, which at Schroeder's is obviously a part and parcel of what we're focused on with respect to at least including it in our investment decision-making process. How do you do that with respect to banks or high-yield corporate debt or other parts of the credit market?
It gives us a chance to peer further out into the horizon for what we think will be catalysts or how an asset will perform. And the reason why ESG factors, some of which have always been part of traditional credit research or fundamental credit research, governance is the one that everyone cites, because at the end of the day, when you lend money to someone, you want to know that you're dealing with someone who is, or a firm that is respectable and has good standards and will follow the rules. So governance has always been around, but it's been often a gut feeling, or it's been anecdotal or conjecture. I kind of like the way this guy looks, or this guy operates, or this company deals with people. Today, we're taking those anecdotes and we're converting them into facts. We're looking at the board composition. We're looking at Glassdoor surveys. We're looking at employee satisfaction, customer satisfaction. We're looking at supply chains. And we are coming up with a holistic view that's not only based on governance, but also the environmental and social. And, you know, we have proprietary tools that actually assess the social value that a firm provides to the economy. And why that's important is because eventually a social benefit will accrue to the providers of capital to a firm, or the social costs will accrue. Now, traditionally, ESG was an equity-centric concept where if you didn't like the way a company was being run, you would vote with your shares. But remember, in capital markets, the vast majority of capital that's provided to the market is in the form of credit. Credit investors are a much more meaningful part of a company's balance sheet, whether it's a bank or an industrial, high yield, or emerging markets. And so by being able to raise or lower the cost of capital, you essentially impact the management's decisions. That's the form of engagement, in addition to the traditional form of engagement of trying to understand where the management team wants to take the company or how they'll address the controversy.
Well, David, let me ask you that as a final question with respect to how credit investors can apply leverage, and I don't mean it in the credit sense, but operating leverage against, in favor of or opposed to management in the credit markets. Can they demand a premium return on companies that don't necessarily have great ESG scores, or can they, in fact, discount the rate at which they're willing to accept interest if indeed there's a better score?
I think so, yes. What's happening is ESG is not, it used to be just a comment, you know, how does your firm deal with environmental, social, and governance factors? Now it's becoming a focus by the asset owners. And once this, in the next couple of years, you're going to see what I would consider this feedback loop. And those that have positive ESG factors will slowly get access to more and more efficient and cheaper forms of capital, which will allow them to thrive.
David, a pleasure to have you. Thanks for joining us this week. David Knutson is head of credit research at North America at Schroeder's. I'm Ron Insana. Thanks for joining us on this week's U.S. Lens. We'll be talking to you again soon. Have a good day.
That was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to read more about any of the subjects we've spoken about in these shows, go to schroeders.com/insights. You can listen to a whole back catalogue at schroeders.com/the investor download. If you want to get in touch with us, it's schroederspodcast@schroeders.com. Feel free to pose any questions. And if you want to rate, review, and subscribe to us, you can do that via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, with new shows available on a Monday and Thursday from 5 p.m. UK time. But most importantly, keep safe and go well. Cheers.